Kol HaLashon, the entire Torah, everywhere.
What if the pursuit of happiness is actually the very thing making humanity completely miserable? Today, let's open up the 19 letters written in the 19th century by Reb Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. Letters that will make us look at history differently and help us grasp why we're even here on this planet and what's the purpose. These letters were intricate arguments presented at a time when it was challenging all the new assumptions of modernity in a radical way. It's an intense correspondence between two friends, Binyamin and Naftali, arguing over nothing less than the entire purpose of human existence, the tension between ancient religious law and the modern world, and an understanding of the human duty in this world. Let's start with Binyamin, because his mindset is still relatable today. If you've ever felt completely disconnected from the traditions you grew up with, you feel emotionally disconnected, you'll recognize yourself in him immediately. He's a young man living in 19th century Europe, in Germany, a time of incredible intellectual upheaval, the Enlightenment in full swing. He moved away from his parents' home. He's reading widely philosophers like Kant, Shakespeare. And because all of this, he has completely abandoned his religious practices. And he doesn't abandon them quietly. He writes to his old friend Naftali with an utterly devastating critique of his religion. He looks at the world of science and art and human progress all around him in Europe. And then he looks at his own people, the Jewish nation, and all he sees is misery, endless suffering and isolation. He describes them as the plaything of fate for 2,000 years, totally excluded from the great cultural advancements of the surrounding nations. What's interesting is that Binyamin is applying a philosophical metric to his own heritage. He states, almost as if it were an undeniable law of physics, that the ultimate end of man is happiness and perfection. Maximizing happiness with Kantian ideals of human perfectibility. Kant writes that humans could become perfect and well-behaved, and then people will be happy. By that metric, Binyamin argues that Judaism is a catastrophic failure, a system that actively hinders happiness. He looks at the religious rulebook, Shulchan Aruch Chaim. He didn't know about the other three halakim of Eben Ezer, Cheshem, Mishpat, and Yeridaya. He looks at Shulchan Aruch Chaim. All he sees to him are senseless rituals, fasting, praying, restricting what you can or can't eat, restricting when you can and can't work, like Shabbos, Yontif, weekdays.
Kol HaLashon.
Life under the system to him is reduced to a state of anxious scrupulosity over insignificant trifles. You can feel the disconnect in his writing. He compares the broad, universal morality of the philosophers he's reading to the rigid, highly specific and technical laws of the Gemara and the Chumash. He dismisses these ancient laws as rude and illogical. He's essentially saying the world is moving forward into a beautiful, universal brotherhood of reason, and my people are stuck inside arguing over microscopic legal details. If only this Binyamin could have known the future of what this Kantian philosophy will produce in the way of World War I and World War II, the horrors of horrors, what was produced from all this humanitarian liberalism. But let's continue. There's a real emotional weight behind this for him. He's at a turning point in his life, about to get married, thinking about having children. And he admits to Naftali that he literally trembles at the thought of passing down a system he feels so completely broken. It is a genuine crisis of conscience. He even cuts off a potential counter-argument right out of the gate, begging Naftali not to point to the modern reform movements of their era. Because to Binyamin, even reform, trimming away the inconvenient parts of the religion to fit 19th century European sensibilities, are worse than a bandage. They're inconsistent patchwork to his mind. If you have to overhaul the rules to fit modern times, you've essentially admitted the system itself is obsolete. This now puts Naftali in a fascinating position. He's a rabbi, so you'd expect him to defend the rule book. But he sidesteps that typical defensive posture entirely. A brilliant rhetorical move. He starts by addressing Binyamin's underlying assumption that a religious leader will only ever offer a sanitized professional defense of the faith. Naftali calls this the curse of the time, the cynical belief that people only defend their beliefs because it's their job, selling their individuality for bread. He flat out refuses to engage on those terms. So instead of defending the fasting or the kosher's dietary laws right off the bat, Naftali goes straight for the foundation of Binyamin's entire worldview. He pulls the rug out from under him. He challenges the very metric Binyamin is using. He asks a simple but completely devastating question. Who decided that happiness and perfection are the ultimate goals of humanity? Where did you get that baseline, Binyamin? Naftali forces Binyamin to defend his baseline. And he points out a glaring flaw in making happiness the ultimate moral compass. Happiness is completely subjective. If subjective happiness is the goal, what is your argument against a criminal or someone whose sole pursuit in life is sensory pleasure? If an individual finds their ultimate happiness in the momentary thrill of theft or in pure sensual lust, who are you to tell them that they are wrong? If happiness is the only metric, they're succeeding. You have no moral high ground to say they shouldn't do that if it makes them happy. Think of it this way. Picture someone picking up an expensive smartphone and using it as a paperweight because they never bothered to read the manual. They don't know what this phone is made for. Their only metric for a good tool is how heavy it is. A heavy hammer could hold down papers from blowing away in the wind. And this is not a good paperweight. And he says, this iPhone is a terrible paperweight. Binyamin is judging this ancient, intricate system by an external, chosen metric, 19th century European concept of happiness, rather than evaluating the system by its own internal logic. You can't judge a smartphone by its weight. And Naftali is saying, you can't judge the Torah by Kantian philosophy or Shakespeare's plays. It's an unfair test. Naftali insists that if Binyamin actually wants to understand the system, he cannot read the text just to mine it for its historical data or curiosities. He has to read it on its own terms, from the inside out. And Naftali is specific about how you do that. You have to read the text of the Torah Kedoshah in its original Hebrew, not because it sounds nicer or more authentic, but because how the language itself functions. Lashon Kodesh Hebrew, he argues, is fundamentally different from European languages. It is actually construction. He describes it as a semi-symbolic writing, and you focus on the Torah Kodesh in its source, which is the whole writings of Rav Shlomo Shrofol Hirsch's Chumash and Tillim, where he shows you the holiness and how every root Every word has so much depth. Here's what that means in practice. In English, the word earth is just a random collection of sounds we all agree to attach to the ground. There's no inherent meaning in the letters E-A-R-T-H. But in Hebrew, words are built on shiroshim, on three-letter roots that convey conceptual philosophical relationships. Take the Hebrew word for a person, Adam. It shares the exact same root as the word for earth or soil, Adamo. The language itself is physically painting the picture of that relationship. You aren't just a spirit trapped in the physical body. Your very name reminds you that you are formed from the earth. Take the root for compassion, for rachamim, rechem. It is the exact same root as the word for a womb. So mercy isn't an abstract feeling. It's structurally defined by the language itself as the unconditional love a mother has for the life she's carrying. That's why it's called rechem. Because of this, Naftali argues, you cannot passively read the text. The verbal roots are an active matrix of philosophical ideas. So the metric now has to shift completely from does this make me happy to what is the internal logic of this specific system. Let's get to the roots. And we approach the text of the Torah HaKadoshah with a new burning question. The one Naftali poses directly. What are we and what should we be on this earth? To answer it, Naftali invites Binyamin to step inside the architecture of the Torah, to accept its premises hypothetically for a moment and look at the universe from that vantage point. That vantage point begins with the opening claims of Bereshis. The cosmos as a vast interconnected ecosystem created by one active unified force. When you look at nature through this lens, the heavens, the stars, the oceans, the whole cycle of life and death, you find a silent, harmonious ecosystem where everything is a servant of the Creator. Everything is an essential, functional component in a cosmic, gigantic system. Everything has a necessary, vital purpose. A universe built entirely on mutual interdependence. Hashem created a collection of isolated, independent objects. The Chazal described creation as a chain of developments, all interwoven and connected. Picture the water cycle. Water penetrates the earth, nourishes a plant, the plant produces oxygen, the water evaporates, collects in a cloud, falls back into the sea, and repeats a continuous loop. Or think about light. It pierces the atmosphere and interacts with the soil to bring forth plants. No single element in nature has the means to exist in total isolation. Everything receives in order to give and gives in order to receive. Every blade of grass, every thunderclap, every drop of rain is fulfilling its specific designated role in this grand interconnected system of giving and receiving. But if the whole universe is this perfectly harmonious system where everything automatically does what it's supposed to do, where does humanity fit in? Because it's fairly obvious that people do not automatically do what they're supposed to do. And that is exactly the defining tension of the human condition. Man is the only creature that does not serve automatically. The forces of nature obey blindly. Their capacity is hidden from themselves. A cloud doesn't choose to rain. But man has awareness, intellect, and free will. B'tzelem Elokim, in the image of Hashem, which means, not physically, but rather, a man is meant to be a conscious administrator of this earthly state. As David HaMelech says, Kol Shato Tachas Raglov, he's in control of the entire planet. He has the intellect to understand how the entire system works, and the physical ability to alter it. And because he has free will, he's the only creature in the entire universe invited to voluntarily join the cosmic choir and to voluntarily say, I will do what's right. So the goal of humanity is to look at the universe, understand the intricate web of interconnected love and justice holding it together with exactitude, and then actively choose to participate in it, to consciously use the resources, your own intellect, your physical strength, your bank account, to fulfill the will of Hashem, not to hurt anybody, to help everyone according to your power, that they should reach their goal and function in the planet. But free will is exactly the biggest risk there is. Because if you can choose to participate, you can also choose to exploit the system for yourself. And this is how man falls. Naftali extrapolates the brilliant psychological profile of human failure. Freedom inherently postulates the possibility of error. Why? Because you look at Sefer Bereishis, the whole story, Cain the Hevel, the Aflog, and you see that humanity is constantly threatened by a dangerous combination, our animal nature and our intellect. Through the body, we are susceptible to sensual lust. The biological mechanism of life, eating, reproducing, naturally have pleasant sensations attached to them, just to ensure that it's done and that we survive. But man, because he has intellect, could hyper these taivas, he could reflect on them, and gets dazzled by the pleasure. He starts to view pleasure not as a mechanism to sustain life, but as the ultimate end goal of life itself. He prioritizes the sweetness over his duties. He consumes without considering the balance of anything around him. The intellectual trap is pride, science, the development of sciences, because humanity has an incredible mind that can invent tools, control fire, dam rivers, and the modernity, electricity and so on, satellites, and alter the environment. We start to look upon ourselves as the ultimate masters. We think we own this place. We forget that we are just administrators of Hashem's estate, an estate we didn't build. And we think we have the right to subject everything to our own will. Combine the desire for endless physical pleasure with an arrogant intellect that believes it literally owns the world, and you get a tyrant, a beast of prey with a supercomputer for a brain. As Naftali writes, when the mind of the ruler lowers itself to be the slave of the beast, employing all its skill only to secure gratification of bestial desires, the whole world is not safe. Think about Hitler. And here, Rav Hirsch comes to a fascinating understanding of Avodah Zarah, idol worship. He says the toxic combination of lust and pride is the true origin of polytheism, of Avodah Zarah. Usually, when we think of ancient Avodah Zarah, we think of it as a primitive misunderstanding. We don't know where lightning comes from, so we invent a lightning god. But Naftali understands now a psychological reading of history. He argues that when man stops seeing himself as a servant of a unified creator, he loses the capacity to see the universe as a unified system. The consciousness of a single unifying law vanishes for him, because a unified universe demands something of him, a bittle of his essence to that unified purpose. So when man looks at the forces of nature, the sun, the rain, the oceans, he no longer wants to see them as gears in a cosmic, unified system. He fragments them in his mind, starts to see each one as an independent force, and he sees himself as independent, and all he thinks about is how to manipulate all these forces to give his animal desires, his wealth and pleasure. And he fantasizes about bribing these forces to manipulate them, to extract favors from them. If I sacrifice this, give me rain for my crops so I could get rich. And the whole notion becomes to manipulate things for his own desires. He fragments each force and tries to manipulate those forces for himself so that they are detached from the unified system and so that he can detach from serving the unified Hashem. This is very, very deep understanding of what Avodah Zarah is. Look at the Netziv in Parshas Veschanan and Hamik Dovra at length to understand this. So Avodah Zarah is simply born from a desire to manipulate the world for selfish gain without any moral accountability. So if humanity failed this original mandate and ended up with a fractured polytheistic world of tyrants chasing wealth and pleasure, how do you reset it? So the Hashem brought a Mabul, destroyed the world, only Noach was saved, and a fresh start, but it blows up immediately with the Deira Flog, the Migdal Bovel, the same exact thing, the same idea, to unify mankind, build a tower, establish themselves as masters upon the earth without Hashem. Nimrod was Yodea Ribbono Yumechavan Limrod Boy, Shin of Sinei Aviv Shemashamayim, and this was the new repeat of the old mistake again. And then Hashem scattered mankind across different continents, climates, and environments. Why? Because now is a giant global educational experiment that the Rebbeinu Shlomo is making, and humanity can't be a single family anymore, because if there'll be corruption of one family, it's going to infect everybody. So now entire humanity is scattered so that they could constantly rejuvenate themselves. If one nation becomes completely corrupt, there's another nation. And we see this play out over thousands of years. Empires rise. Egyptians, Babylonians, Romans, they enter the historical arena, bring some new capacity of the intellect, and build towers of greatness, military might, wealth, and inevitably every single one of them collapses. It's a brutal, repetitive cycle. They climb to the summit of power, get consumed by luxury and internal decay, and fall to the ground. Says Naftali, this isn't accidental history. It's a necessary, grueling lesson. Humanity had to exhaust every possible alternative, every empire, every ideology, every system built on selfish power to finally realize that worldly greatness without a moral center, a unifying center, is unsustainable. Which brings us back to the question that was bothering Binyamin in the first place. The role of Avraham Avinu and the Jewish people is, while the rest of the world is scattered to build empires, test their intellect, and ultimately fall, Avraham is called out from among them to take a completely different path. Why him? Why create a distinct separate nation at all? Because if the world was going to be saved from this cycle of corruption and destruction, there had to be a living, breathing model of what humanity was actually meant to be. Avraham's task wasn't to build a world power or an empire of wealth, but to found a home dedicated purely to justice, mishpat, love and servicing to Hashem. Service to Hashem, avodas Hashem. A counterexample to the rest of the world. A group whose entire identity wasn't tied to a soil, to a certain land, to material success, but to an absolute commitment to a higher moral law. And this completely flips Binyamin's original argument on its head. Binyamin looked at his people and saw a group that was isolated, miserable, and excluded from the great achievements of European civilization. But Naftali reframes that exact same history. What Binyamin calls miserable isolation was actually a necessary preservation. They were kept apart, tested through suffering, and stripped of political power precisely so they wouldn't get swallowed up by the doomed cycles of worldly empires. So the intricate rulebook that Binyamin found so restrictive, the rituals, the legal details of halacha, the daily restrictions Naftali sees as a spiritual training ground, the rules aren't designed to bring superficial momentary happiness or luxury. They're designed to discipline the animal nature, to curb gaiva and pride, and mold individuals into conscious, selfless servants of Hashem. It's a complete paradigm shift. Binyamin was asking, why does this system make us so unhappy and out of step with the modern world? Naftali responds, because the modern world's definition of happiness is built on a flawed, self-centered foundation. If your metric is comfort, the path of duty looks like a burden. But if your metric is aligning your life with the fundamental architecture of the universe, with justice, love, and responsibility, then that very same rulebook becomes the highest form of human freedom. This shows, in a fascinating way, how two people could be staring at the exact same set of facts, the exact same history, and come away with two completely opposite interpretations, depending entirely on the lens they choose to look through. So this is an overview of the amazing 19 letters of Rabbi Hirsch.
Kol HaLashon, a whole world of quality content.